And that's, excuse me, that's my son, who's good in a pinch. There's no chair for this session. Uh-oh, I just did something bad. my paper today actually sort of falls into two parts. I'm going to spend a little bit of time just talking about working on these journals. Wilfred Woodruff's journals in the TypeScript version are 5,400 pages long, kept a journal for 65 years. And my task was to make a 400-page version of these journals for publication, so I had to quite a choice of selection to do. And obviously, working with something that big took me a long time. So the first thing I want to do is just talk a little bit about my experience of working with those huge journals, and then give you my response to sort of one dominant theme I found in the journals, which was what we used in the title of the book, which we're calling Waiting for World's End. And I've called this Waiting for World's End, My Enforced Confinement with Wilfred Woodruff. I did not come to Wilfred Woodruff's journals on an intellectual or a spiritual quest. I was a graduate student and a single mother, and I needed money. So I made my bargain with Signature Books. First I would prepare an index, then I would prepare the one-volume selection of entries. Like Faust, I learned that the bargainer must eventually make her reckoning. Mine has been what I now think of as my enforced confinement with a 19th century patriarch, hundreds of hours spent over a space of several years with a man I would not, as a matter of personal inclination, have chosen to know. The index was published in 1991. This one volume will finally be out this spring. Wilfred was a great believer in dreams. He consulted his own and those of others, and recorded them in great detail in his journals. I have joked with friends that I keep expecting Wilfred's concerned or angry visage in my own dreams. He had such a sense of destiny about his journals and their purpose for his future readers that I cannot imagine he would be unconcerned with this project of mine. I also realize he would never have chosen me, a rather skeptical feminist, for the task. During the terms of this enforced confinement, I have found myself in an increasingly strenuous dialogue with Wilfred about his journals and the audience he imagined for them, which must necessarily differ from my selection for this volume and the rather more diverse audience I hope it will ultimately find. Perhaps I have felt pressured by his claims precisely because of my own growing sense of Wilfred's achievement as a diarist. Something like awe has come to me through the sheer labor of dealing with these massive journals. Wilfred began keeping what became virtually a daily diary at his conversion in late 1833 and wrote until 2 days before his death in 1898, some 65 years later, the ending for his chronicle of his final illness, written as it only could have been by his death. In March 1857, he left to chronicle illnesses and of other people and his own, and on one occasion, I mean, I say this, it could only have been written by his death, because on one occasion he writes, you know, I have been poisoned and I think I'm going to die, so I'm going to write about what happens to someone who's been poisoned. And he does, until he gets so sick he can no longer write, and then he comes back once he gets better and doesn't die and fills in all the details of everything else. And so, and he does actually write about the operation that ultimately killed him and about some of the after effects. And the final entry of the journal is 2 days before he dies. In March 1857, he spoke to a group of bishops about the subject of keeping a journal. In this speech, he talked about his compulsion to keep the diary and his estimate of its importance. I have had this same subject of keeping records upon my mind ever since I became a member of the church, he told the bishops. I have been inspired and moved upon to keep a journal and write the affairs of this church as far as I can. I did not understand why my feelings was exercised so much in the early age of this church, but I understand it now. I seldom ever heard Brother Joseph or the 12 preach or teach any principle, but what I felt as uneasy as a fish out of water until I had written it. Then I felt right. I could write a sermon of Joseph's a week after it was delivered, almost word for word, and after it was written, it was taken from me or from my mind. This was a gift from God unto me, and I have kept a journal of almost every day of my life for the last 24 years. I could tell each day what I had done, what company I was in, and what was transpiring around me, and any teachings or counsels from the presidency of the church. And I have urged the same course upon the 12 and the quorums of the church, to keep a record of their meetings and the dealings of God with them, and for all men who bear the priesthood, to keep a record of their lives, especially of all of their official acts in the church and kingdom of God. You may say that this has been a great deal of trouble. Very well, it has been to me in one sense. It has occupied nearly every leisure moment of my time for 24 years. But what of it? I have never spent any of my time more profitably for the benefit of mankind than in my journal writing, for a great portion of the church history has been compiled from my journals, and some of the most unique gospel sermons, truths, and revelations that were given from God to this people through the mouth of the prophets Joseph, Brigham, Heber, and the 12 could not be found upon the earth on record only in my journals, and they are compiled in the church history and transmitted to the saints in all future generations. Does this not pay me for my trouble? It does. The Lord has told us that what we seal on earth shall be sealed in heaven, and what we record on earth shall be recorded in heaven, and what is not sealed or recorded on earth is not sealed or recorded in heaven. Therefore, it appears to be very important that we do keep a true and faithful record in all things. This passage captures the central, consuming, compulsive, and Wilford's compulsive about everything, and for Wilford, mysterious nature of his journal keeping. Following in the Mormon tradition of investing the details of life with supernatural, eternal significance, Wilford transforms the tedium of a meticulous daily journal into achievement of cosmic proportions. This compulsion to remember and to write may consume every leisure moment of his life, but the official history for the saints of God in all future generations depends on his work. Implicitly, this passage parallels the work of his journals with the work of temples. Only what is sealed on earth can be sealed in heaven. Only what is recorded on earth can be recorded and remembered in heaven. By 1857, 24 years after he began the journal, Wilford is already participating in the ongoing transformation of his journal into the official history of the institution. This process will continue for the next 40 years. Not only does the journal bear the weight, then, of Wilford's private sense of divine vocation, but it becomes a document which is underwritten and ultimately revised by the institution as its official history. This fuzzy boundary between the public and private status of the journal is only increasingly blurred as Wilford ascends the ladder of church authority, with fewer and fewer moments ever considered private. It is not insignificant either that the public nature of this journal is explicitly acknowledged in this passage as male. Men who bear the priesthood are to write records of this kind. What they are to record are the official acts of the institution, acts conducted by men, speeches made by men, meetings conducted largely among men. The public and institutional claims for this journal thus necessarily turn its attention away from private and domestic spaces. My attentions and my allegiances are most naturally captured by the margins, by that which is unauthorized and devalued by the powers that be. My own work has been characterized by attention to the negotiation between private and domestic spaces in the larger public space. My strenuous dialogue with Wilford, then, has often concerned itself with whether his claims or mine would win out. Overall, I could report to Wilford, were he to come to me in my dreams. And actually, I think this is a good test. If he doesn't, I'm not sure that I could ever be convinced to believe in the other side. Overall, I would report to Wilford that my selection of entries for this volume has ultimately reflected his dominant concern for institutional history. But admitting that I have admitted certain of my inclinations to Wilford's claims, I am, of course, not telling the whole story. My own interest as a scholar in that which tests, even disrupts the comfortable ease of received views in the status quo, has helped to structure my selection process, Certainly the selections reflect my judgment about what is important and also my judgment about what remains striking and interesting, even surprising or provocative. These latter criteria would have at best made no sense to Wilford. Here then is one side of the strenuous dialogue I have described between Wilford and me, between the claims of his project and the claims of mine. Nothing I have included would in its time have embarrassed or concerned Wilford, for as he describes in the above passage, what happens to the church on earth needs to be recorded and remembered. But in the 20th century, the institution has distanced itself from much of what I have included, and as a result, it has rewritten, or perhaps more typically ignored or hidden, many of the events and discussions which to me, perhaps in part because of a context of institutional silence, seem striking or compelling. I include them then in large measure because of my own sense of history, but I believe in this matter, my view of history does not intrude itself in place of Wilford's. His commitment to see that everything which happened in the 19th century church was recorded and remembered does not seem so far removed from my own. Frankly, I am relieved to be finished with this project, but my own drive for closure only faintly mimes Wilford's consuming drive, his animating wish, captured in the title chosen for this one volume, Waiting for World's End. Waiting is the dominant structuring impulse in Wilford's life, and Wilford's waiting accounts both for that which most distances me from him and that which ultimately calls out my sympathy. Wilford's conviction that Jesus Christ would come quickly, bringing a cataclysmic ending to the sufferings of the saints and clean revenge on their enemies, was inextricably linked to his testimony of the Restoration. Wilford's first church call was as a soldier of Zion's camp, armed to defend God's people against the evil and threatening world. The men were armed with dirks, pistols, swords, and rifles for self-defense, wrote Wilford in the first pages of his journal. There he also described his own first gift to the prophet Joseph Smith, his sword. On his first missionary journal, only months later in the South, bringing the good news of the restored Mormon gospel became intertwined with cursing its enemies. Repeatedly, Wilford and his missionary companions retired to the edge of a stream in order to wash their hands and feet of their enemies' blood.
You have to go right face onto that in order to get you on it.
They may not get me on it. I can't talk with a microphone in my mouth. Repeatedly, Wilford and his companions retired to the edge of a stream in order to wash their hands and feet of their enemies' blood, to perform a solemn duty that is required of all elders of Israel whose testimony is rejected by this generation, he wrote. We then, according to commandment, cleansed our hands and feet and bore testimony unto God against the mob and many others who had rejected our testimony. Not surprisingly, a man who imagined the world in such violent and oppositional terms would see God's hand painting the skies red with blood as a sign of the coming end. Soon after arriving in Kirtland, Ohio, for example, Wilford wrote, "At early candlelight, the heavens began to show forth the signs in fulfillment of the prophecy of Joel. The clouds of fire and blood began to arise. The reflection of the clouds upon the earth, which was covered with snow, presented a very red appearance. The heavens were covered with pure red." The violence and extremity of these images, apocalypse, war, blood, fire, helps to account for their power to animate and sustain believers like Wilford. Wilford records Joseph Smith's description of the animating power of such excess of living beyond the bounds of everyday life in the commonplace world. Excitement has almost become the essence of my life, Joseph tells a group of associates over a supper a year before his death. When that dies away, I feel almost lost. When a man is reined up continually by excitement, he becomes strong and gains power and knowledge. But when he relaxes for a season, he loses much of his power and knowledge. In this passage, Joseph quite strikingly installs excitement as the animating impulse behind his own sense of strength and power and knowledge. He implicitly admits as well both the lure and the danger of such a structuring impulse. In the language of being reined up continually by excitement, can be seen a suggestion of the obsessional and libidinal nature of this energy. In contrast, when he relaxes, he loses much of his power and knowledge. This patterning of excitement and relaxation, extraordinary and ordinary, as empowerment and loss, reveals the problematic nature of Joseph's way of accounting for power and knowledge. Enduring the ordinary, the commonplace, becomes the challenge, even the threat to powerful existence, promoting excitement, its wishful goal. Wilfred's belief in the world's imminent and violent end provided such excitement, an animating energy for Wilfred's sense of power and knowledge for himself, for his church. In contrast, waiting for world's end, living on and on and on in a commonplace world, enduring the accumulating decades of an ordinary human life, brought the ultimate challenge to Wilfred's imagination and to his faith. Wilfred's patience had already been tested, 30 years of faithful waiting for Christ's return, when he spoke in Logan on 23rd August 1868. When these boys and girls meet together 30 years hence in 1898 and converse together upon the scenes of this visit, what will be their conversation? Wilfred asked those assembled. He answered with the following preview of 30 years hence. Then it was a new country with but few inhabitants, not more than 10,000 people in all Cache Valley. Then we had no tabernacle or temple in this valley. Now we have a great tabernacle and a great temple built on the high bench of Logan, and we can be drawn on the top of its towers by machinery, where we can view the glory of this valley filled with cities and magnificent palaces and towns occupied by 1,000,000 of the saints of God who can come up to the temple on Logan Bench and get their endowments and blessings in their turn. Then the Apostle E.T. Benson and Bishop Mann presided over us. Since then, they have gone with President Young and others to Jackson County, Missouri, to build the Great Temple and the New Jerusalem. This visit was in 1868. Then we were children. Now it is 1898, and great changes have taken place since that day throughout Great Babylon, as well as in Mount Zion. That year was the great election for the presidency of the United States. Then the nation felt strong and powerful. Since then it has been broken to pieces. That visit was before the destruction of the city of New York by the sea heaving itself beyond its bounds and washing the inhabitants into the sea, and they were drowned. It was before Albany was utterly destroyed by fire. It was before Boston was sunk with an earthquake. It was before Chicago was struck with lightning and burned with fire and brimstone for their abominations. It was before the many millions of the people of the United States and other nations of the earth were destroyed with their cities by the great judgments of God because of their great sins and wickedness in the sight of heaven and earth. This was before the United States became so weakened and broken to pieces that they called upon Brigham Young to take the presidency of the United States to save the Constitution and the remnant of the nation from utter destruction. If this will not be the conversation of those little children who were in the procession with their banners to welcome the prophet and apostles on their entrance into the city 30 years from this, it will be something like it. Wilfred added that, quote, President Young said my remarks were given by revelation. In fact, 30 years later, almost to the day, on 27 August 1898, Wilfred Woodruff was in heathen territory at a meeting of the exclusive men's club, the Bohemian Club, in San Francisco, California, rather than in New Jerusalem's temple in Jackson County, Missouri. He died in San Francisco a few days later, on the 2nd of September. The distance could scarcely have been greater between the scenario predicted by Wilfred and warranted by Brigham and the very different story which unfolded for Wilfred in the church during the 1890s, with Wilfred, not Brigham, as its prophet. A temple did stand on the Logan Bench, as Wilfred predicted, but the rest of Wilfred's vision had failed, and the temple, rather than the signs of power, Wilfred predicts, had become, in an ironic twist of Wilfred's story, the focus of struggles displaying the church's weakness within fin de siècle political and economic arenas. The national campaign to force the LDS Church to abandon polygamy became the first sore test to Wilfred's waiting. Year after year, Wilfred continued to predict God's imminent intervention in the church's struggle with the federal government. For example, on New Year's Day, 1886, he wrote, "But we will maintain that God reigns and will until he puts all enemies under his feet, and he will fight the battles of his saints, and he will bring judgment upon our enemies and destroy them in his own due time. This is the testimony of Wilfred Woodruff. At the close of this year, look to this page and see what the signs of the year has been." At year's end, he wrote from inside the St. George Temple, where he was hiding from U.S. Marshals pursuing his arrest on anti-polygamy charges. This New Year's Day, 1887, finds scores of the leading men of the church in prison and the presidency in 12 and many others in exile for obeying the law of God. But the God of Israel still reigns, and he will protect the righteous and defend his kingdom and fulfill his promises, where the end of this year will find the presidency in 12, apostles of the church, and myself in particular, time will tell. In each new year, Wilfred would find the hope of the church's triumph and God's end to the world. In each year's end, another round of quiet revisions and deferrals. Yet the violent and apocalyptic continued to animate his dreams, his visions, his revelations. In 1878, for example, he recorded a horrifyingly detailed version of the vision of the dying cities. In that vision, as in his talk in Logan, he wrote of the extremity of New York City's ending. "In wandering down Broadway, I saw the bodies of beautiful women lying stone dead, and others in a dying condition on the sidewalk. I saw men crawl out of the cellars and rob the dead bodies of the valuables they had. And before they could return to their coverts in the cellars, they themselves would roll over a time or two and die in agony. On some of the back streets, I saw mothers kill their own children and eat raw flesh, and then in a few minutes, die themselves. Wherever I went, I saw the same scenes of horror and desolation, rapine and death." 2 years later, on the 26th of January, 1880, the same extreme still haunted his sleep. While on the underground in Arizona, Wilfred described receiving his what came to be known as the wilderness revelation. "When the vision of my mind was opened to comprehend the corruptions and the judgments of God and destruction which awaited them, and when I comprehended the great and mighty responsibility which rested upon the quorum of the apostles in the sight of God and the heavenly hosts, my head became a fountain of tears, and my pillow was wet with the dews of heaven, and sleep departed from me. And the Lord revealed unto me our duty, even the duty of the 12 apostles and all the faithful elders of Israel, while dwelling in a shepherd's tent in the wilderness surrounded by drifting snows of the mountains, while wrapped in the visions of the night." What the Lord revealed was that the first presidency and 12 apostles were to compile a list of the church's enemies. Quote, "All men and persons who have taken part in persecuting you or bringing distress upon you or your families or have sought your lives or sought to hinder you from keeping my commandments or from enjoying the rights which the constitutional laws of the land guarantee unto you. They were to lay this list on the prayer altar in the temple and, quote, "bring all these testimonies before my face and before the heavenly hosts and before the justified spirits made perfect, let them go forth and cleanse their feet in pure water and bear testimony of it unto your Father who is in heaven." By cursing their enemies in the temple, they would guarantee God's judgments on them, just as years before Wilfred's curses by the quiet streams of the south had guaranteed judgment on the enemies of God there. The revelation continued, promising the apocalypse and God's intervention in the affairs of the state of the saints. "I will not stay my hand in judgment upon this nation or the nations of the earth. I have decreed wars and judgments upon the wicked, and my wrath and indignation are about to be poured out upon them, and the wicked and rebellious shall know that I am God. As I, the Lord, have spoken, so will I, the Lord, fulfill. I will spare none who remain in Babylon, but I will burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts. As I, the Lord, have suffered, so will I put all enemies under my feet. For I, the Lord, utter my word, and it shall be obeyed, and the day of wrath and indignation shall come upon the wicked. Wilford submitted his revelation to Church President John Taylor and the 12th. Wilford was asked to draw up a list of the enemies and to write the prayer of damnation, which he did. And the list of enemies exists. It's a very detailed list, over 400 names on it, of various and sundry people who had done things against the church. On 19th January 1881, the First Presidency and 12 met together in this reverse prayer temple in the Salt Lake Temple and, quote, "We all performed the ordinances of washing our feet against our enemies and the enemies of the kingdom of God according to the commandment of God unto us." And this ritual was later repeated in the St. George Temple. And then, according to Wilford's journal, the women drew up a similar list and did a similar ritual in the St. George Temple. By 1889, Wilford had himself become president of the church. On the 24th of November, now it's important to keep in date, this is 1889, this is a year before the manifesto. You can still get a sense of the way his language is about the practice of polygamy and about what's going to happen in terms of God's defense of it. By 1889, Wilford had himself become president of the church. On 24th November, he recorded another revelation, the way he termed it, which continued the same defiant discourse of enemies and ends. "I, Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world, am in your midst. These judgments are at the door. They will be fulfilled as God lives. Leave judgment with me. It is mine, saith the Lord. Watch the signs of the time, and they will show the fulfillments of the words of God. Great events wait you in this generation and are nigh at your doors. Awake, O Israel, and have faith in God and his promises. Be faithful until I come. I come quickly to reward every man according to the deeds done in the body." Only a year later, on the 25th of September, 1890, a tormented, weakened Wilford was driven to write these chastened words in his diary as preface to the manifesto. "I have arrived at a point in the history of my life as the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints where I am under the necessity of acting for the temporal salvation of the Church. The United States government has taken a stand and passed laws to destroy the Latter-day Saints upon the subject of polygamy and patriarchal order of marriage, and after praying to the Lord and feeling inspired by His Spirit, I have issued the following proclamation." A more personal register of language has captured Wilford's journal on this day. He writes of, quote, "the history of my life as the president rather than the history of the church. I have issued the proclamation," he writes, employing the first person pronoun, whereas only a year before, "I, Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world," had been speaking confidently about the future of the church from the pages of Wilford's diary. Faced with federal confiscation of church property, including the sacred and secret temples, and no supernatural help in sight, Wilford had been forced to act himself, quote, "for the temporal salvation of the church." Only a week earlier, Wilford had been in San Francisco, soliciting help and advice on the church's political and financial troubles from secular, largely Gentile, power brokers beyond the confines of Brigham's Great Basin. As the end, which Wilford had sought, deferred itself, he found himself living on in this world. He was more and more in this world, ever more estranged from the thrilling future he forecast. Instead of heavens painted with blood, this 80-something man confronted corporate ledgers marked with red of a different kind. More and more, he faced not the night visions of a prophet in the wilderness, but corporate decisions about whether to build a dam to generate electricity for lights and elevators and streetcars, or whether to invest in a newly proposed telephone company. Even his inspiration to finish the Salt Lake Temple, finally an ending he could control, contributed to the institutional debt which increasingly burdened Wilford and the church in his final years. His days became consumed with a tenuous juggling act, keeping a stressed Mormon institution afloat financially. Repeatedly, he confided his exhaustion to his journal. And I find this period of his journal just excruciating to read. If you figure this is a 90-something man who's basically having to make all the financial and corporate decisions for the church, which is badly in debt and you know, in danger of collapsing at any minute. And these are just a sampling of the kinds of things that are in here. He writes, the 8th of August, 1894, I am worked altogether too hard. I don't sleep nights and am weary by day. On 17th of September, 1896, he writes, it looks as though the presidency would be ruined unless God opens the way. Our affairs are in a desperate condition in a temporal point of view. On the 30th of December, 1896, he writes, we, the presidency of the church, are so overwhelmed in financial matters, it seems as though we should never live to get through with it unless the Lord opens the way in a marvelous manner. It looks as though we should never pay our debts. And I think it's interesting, that doubt, that concern that God, I mean, it doesn't say God will open the heavens. We are concerned if God would open the heavens. These poignant entries resonate with a dream which Wilfrid had recorded shortly after his 78th birthday in 1885, some 8 years after Brigham Young's death, and of course some 15 before his own death. I had the following dream in the night. I dreamed the presidency and 12 apostles were about to take a mission together, and President Brigham Young called on me to pray. And while praying, the Spirit of the Lord rested upon me in a powerful manner. And when I closed, President Young laid his hands upon my head and blessed me and ordained me to something. I do not remember what it was. He said, I was one born out of due time. The tears ran down my face while he was blessing me. Waiting for the world's end, hoped for at first as a cosmic event, but increasingly imagined as a welcome personal release, Wilfrid began feeling himself a man living out of due time. His life story had played out on the concrete state of life, the tensions and ironies implicit in Joseph Smith's candid description of the dialectic between ordinary and extraordinary, which crucially animates religious experience. As I think of Wilfrid Woodruff waiting for world's end, I cannot keep from my mind the echoing experience of Estragon and Vladimir in Samuel Beckett's 20th century play, Waiting for Godot. Each day the pair return to the same tree in hopes of keeping their appointment with Godot, who each evening sends a message that he will come tomorrow. As the waiting extends and recapitulates itself, the two find it increasingly difficult to remember who Godot is, or how and why they made the appointment, where they are supposed to meet him, whether they actually made an appointment with someone named Godot, whether there was ever someone named Godot, whether any of this seems like a good idea after all. At one point, Vladimir muses on why they keep waiting. What are we doing here? That is the question, and we are blessed in this that we happen to know the answer. Yes, in the immense confusion, one thing alone is clear. We are waiting for Godot to come, or the night to fall. We have kept our appointment, and that's the end to that. We are not saints, but we have kept our appointment. How many people can boast as much? All I know is that the hours are long under these conditions and constrain us to beguile them with proceedings which, how shall I say, which may at first seem reasonable until they become a habit. You may say it is to prevent our reason from foundering, no doubt, but has it not long been straying in the night without end of the abyssal depths? That's what I sometimes wonder. In these words, Vladimir captures both the dangers and the accomplishments of waiting, and ultimately focuses a certain indecidability about which is which. The dangers are evoked by way of the proceedings which may beguile, but time hardens into habits. Danger lies as well in the ambiguous distance between Vladimir's deployment of the term reasonable and his echo in the word reason. Only at first do the proceedings seem reasonable, but they may also be seen as ploys to save reason. Are the preceding inhabitants ultimately then the signs of reason or of madness? The difference here is left indecipherable. But there is evoked as well the accomplishment of waiting, keeping one's appointment. Though, of course, even this sense of accomplishment is undercut by Vladimir's uncertainty about the substance of this appointment, waiting for Godot or waiting for the sunset. This uncertainty advertises an existentially troubling dilemma. Can the waiting end, or is there only the promise of return, here figured as the daily loss of the sun. Embedded in the uncertainties of the situation lie central questions which bedevil religious aspiration. Can existence ultimately support the conviction that time is in some sense teleological, goal-oriented, progressive, meaningful, or does time insist itself as a matter of chance and repetition with no possibility for escape, radical transformation, closure? Can God bring his own ends, transform earthly history into the eternity of heaven, or must humans endure the different returns of nature? It is the burden of this latter possibility which structures the final moment of Beckett's play. Vladimir and Estragon consider the possibility of wresting a responsible at the ending from Godot. "Why don't we hang ourselves?" Vladimir says. But they can find no rope. And here's the exchange that happens between them. Estragon, "You say we have to come back tomorrow?" Vladimir, "Yes." Estragon, "Then we can bring a good bit of rope." "Yes." Didi, "Yes." "I can't go on like this." "That's what you think. If we parted, that might be better for us." "We'll hang ourselves tomorrow, unless Godot comes. And if he comes, we'll be saved." Vladimir and Estragon are most immediately evoked as absurd comic figures. Their rituals at worst disgusting, at best ridiculous. But Beckett's play also allows the pair a measure of pathos and dignity. Despite the absurdity of their situation, their waiting is punctuated with moments of energy and grace, evoked through small events, as when they help one another off with their boots. It is something like the way I respond to Vladimir and Estragon in Beckett's play that I find myself reacting ultimately with sympathy to Wilfred Woodruff. I feel such a gulf between myself and the violent and vengeful images which animate the religious energy of Wilfred's pages. So much of what is painful for me in the 19th century legacy of the LDS Church can be found in the lure of this language of excess and violence, the structuring energy of largely male rituals of war and enemies and armies and blood. But waiting enforces on Wilfred a different register of existence, the dailiness of habit and proceedings. And unfortunately, this is the sort of thing that's hard to keep in something like a one volume, but some of the things that I find most ultimately moving about Wilfred are Wilfred the gardener, Wilfred the fisherman, Wilfred, out in the mountains with his sons, taking care of the sheep, Wilfred going to watch an operation, which he loves to do. Wilfred reading books. He reads hundreds of books, and it's amazing what these books are, history books, political science. I mean, he's a man who has an immense gift for filling daily life with these habits and proceedings. And it is, in the end, Wilfred's capacity for human time, not God's promised world on the other end of human history, which moves me. His talent for waiting made of him the leader who taught his church to change and compromise and thus to live on and on into the 20th century. Like Moses, this 19th century prophet did not enter the new land, but he brought the saints to its border and made possible the conditions which would allow his church to accommodate the daily, the temporal, the natural, and thus to go on waiting for the supernatural, for God's promises and God's ends.
Now, the mythical Paul Condy could not come, so I took his place. I'm Doug Condy from the Oakland First Ward. I found that the preparation for these comments difficult because, first of all, I have not read the volumes of Wilfred's journals, and I also have not had the benefit of reading the index nor the one-volume book. So I chose to focus on commenting on the image that the paper gives us of Wilfred Woodruff. The author quotes a talk given in 1868 in which Wilfred presents a view of the church and the nation 30 years hence. And then towards the end of the paper, we're given this reality of an old, bitter, exhausted man trying to confront the realities of a church that has been ravaged by persecution over the last 40 or 50 years. However, I come to the view that this vision that he presented to these young people in 1868 was already corrupted in its birth by the fortress mentality that dominated Wilford. This mentality was brought on, I think, by years of persecution that was focused in the beginning generally on the church, but by this time was increasingly focused on the practice of polygamy. The picture provided in the paper is of a Wilford Woodruff whose writings are increasingly dominated by otherworldly speculation about God meting out retributions to the church's enemies. She talks of Wilford's writings as a compulsion that dominates his leisure time and of waiting as a structure that dominates his life, waiting for God to provide this retribution to the church's enemies. One thing that particularly rang true in the description was the tendency or the story about Wilford and the leaders of the church getting together to wash their feet of their enemies. And that rings true because I see that tendency even today in young missionaries adopting this kind of attitude towards people that they are proselyting that will not let them in the door and so on. But I think that all consuming passions tend to blind and channel one's view of the world. And I also feel that the author provides unquestionable support for how these passions consumed Wilford's view of the world. But I see also that in the Faustian bargain that the author made, which she freely admits to, has imposed some blinders on her view of, or at least the view that the paper presents of Wilford Woodruff. Because while I see in the paper evidence of a multidimensional person, the paper focuses on the unidimensional aspect of Wilford's life, namely his dominance with his otherworldly speculation about God's retribution. She describes in Wilford's journal writing a compulsion consuming every leisure moment of his life. The term compulsion implies to me an imbalance. But the author quotes a statement that Wilford recognized in his writings of the sermons of Joseph Smith a means by which he was able to achieve understanding and insight into their meaning. I do not view this as a process of compulsion, but rather a very rational recognition on Wilford Woodruff's part that this is what worked. This is the way he came to an understanding of these teachings. And I think his experience here recalls the very same process that Joseph Smith went through in translating the Bible, and that many of us do find that through the process of writing about an issue, for me particularly a religious issue, is a means of attaining a greater understanding of the issue. The author quotes Wilford's description of Joseph Smith in the statement, quote, "Excitement has almost become the essence of my life." I think this quote shows Wilford to be not only an exacting chronicler of events, but also an astute observer of motivation behind these events. I remember back in the late 70s in our gospel doctrine class in the Oakland First Ward, we were studying Donna Hill's book on Joseph Smith. And the feeling that she conveyed in that book of Joseph Smith in the years 1843 and 44 are very much in concert with Wilford's description there. Like this was a merry-go-round that was spinning and spinning greater and greater, and ultimately Joseph falls off the merry-go-round. The paper also presents waiting as a dominant structuring impulse in Wilford's life. While the journals represent a singular achievement, as an observant and a chronicler, which I think and this chronicle was increasingly dominated by speculations about how the Lord would mete out this player in church history. He just didn't write about it. And his acts had a major influence upon the course that church history took, both in the beginning of the time when he was writing the journals and at the end. So I don't think we can separate these acts from his writing. For example, his missionary work in the late 1830s and 1840s, when he went to England, had great success in converting the members of the United Brethren, established a base in England which provided a steady stream of English saints to support the development of Nauvoo, to sustain the church in the emigration to Utah, and to provide many of the skills that were of great value in colonizing the Intermountain West. Finally, I think there is the most important act of his life, the issuing of the manifesto. I view the practice of polygamy as a corrupting and corrosive influence on the church, one that the leadership allowed to threaten the church's continued existence. And the author provides ample evidence of how this practice and the persecution that it engendered corrupted Wilford's view of the world. A review of the revelations claimed by church leaders in the 1880s, for example, John Taylor's revelation on the everlasting nature of polygamy in 1886, and Wilford Woodruff's echoing of this revelation in a statement made December 19, 1889, that, quote, "the doctrine of plural marriage has come to stay for all time," are indicative of how this practice corrupted the institution of revelation. There is also the example of the duplicitous actions of the church leadership, including Wilford Woodruff, in continuing to sanction plural marriage after the manifesto, when they were saying publicly that it had ended. I believe it is significant that Wilford was the one to make his trip outside of Utah to San Francisco to consult with the so-called power brokers outside the church prior to his issuing the manifesto. If you compare this in stark contrast to the statements of John Taylor, who is president of the church, issued this late revelation about polygamy and continued moving in the Mormon underground out of touch with the world, I think we can see possibly one reason why it was Wilford Woodruff who issued the manifesto. Through it all, I find it fascinating that a leader, namely Wilford Woodruff, who was so thoroughly identified and committed and imbued and consumed by the practice of of polygamy, could achieve a mental breakthrough to issue the manifesto and to sanction a course of action that was a complete reversal of 50 years of church history. And so I conclude that the concept of waiting and the analogy to waiting for Godot, with its emptiness and futility and pointlessness of Estragon and Vladimir's existence, do not ring true to the active life and the role that that Wilford Woodruff played in determining church history and in his writing of the journals. Thank you.
We have a couple of minutes and no one to run this thing, so if you have any questions or for either of us, I'd be glad to. Yeah, back there.
I'd like to ask about that point for us.
Well, what happened is he had this revelation which said they were supposed to do this, and he sent the revelation to John Taylor, who was the president of the church. Wilford was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, and they said, this is a good idea, it's a revelation, so you write the prayer and you make the list. So Wilford did, and the prayer is in his journal. The list isn't, but it exists, and I have a copy of it. It's really interesting to see. So they all met together. The presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve met together in the Salt Lake Temple in a prayer circle and cursed these 400 people on the list of damnation, basically, which is just, like I tried to point out, an extension of this idea of cursing your enemies. Wilford does it all the time when he's on missions. I mean, for me, it seems like a good excuse to go off and put his feet in the water, which he loves. I mean, he's a great outdoorsman. It's sort of the same thing. He dreams about fish all the time and explains that it's really about missionary work. But if you read those journals, you know very well it's about fish, you know. But they did that, and then he was the president of the St. George Temple, and they did it again down in St. George. And it's very cryptic what he writes about the women, but he says that he talked to, that the women made up a similar list under Eliza Snow and did some sort of similar ritual in St. George, according to the journals.
Persecuted remorseless.
It's not unusual. I think part of the reason that it's probably very extreme in Wilford, and this sort of goes partly to your word about obsessional. I don't mean obsessional as being crazy, but I do think Wilford is an extraordinary compulsive person. And in fact, I talked to a friend of mine who's, you know, like a counselor, and she gave me like all of the, you know, the thing of what you would call a sort of a compulsive, what's the personality? I mean, because he does. I mean, he does amazing things. Like, for example, when he's on his mission in England, yeah, he did convert thousands of people, but he also did incredibly detailed looking at the wonderful things in England. And he has one incredible, like, 20-page entry of the Tower of England in which he measures the thing. I mean, you know, it's like so many feet this way and so many feet that way, and there's so many bricks and they're this. And he's just, everything he does, he's absolutely thorough and compulsive about it and complete, and I think that that's part of it. I mean, like, what he does is he goes through the newspapers, and he makes lists of signs of the time, you know, of bad things that are happening will show, and he lists them in his journal. You know, there's a earthquake and such, so many people died and so and so. I mean, he's just so thorough in everything he does. But I also would want to say that I'm obviously picking out one thing, and it's also the other thing that's so amazing about this journal is, given how complete he is, it's also full of all kinds of amazing daily things, too. Yeah.
At one time, I know the death of Joseph Smith and those who were...
Oh, yeah, and there's a lot of that in there, and a lot of talk. I mean, you get a really good sense of where this whole discourse of blood atonement and things like that come from, you know, because there's a lot of that in there, and it's very much part of Wilford's idea. I mean, I, for one, never figured out, I mean, it finally occurred to me within the context of this journal why people got so upset at Amos Lyman, particular heresy on the atonement. And Wilford puts it in the context of this blood atonement. I mean, Amos Lyman's particular heresy was to talk about the atonement maybe having some sort of metaphoric, you know, bent to it. And Wilford's horrified at the notion that anyone would claim it was anything about shedding blood and Joseph shedding blood and people, you know, shedding blood. That's very important. And he's horrified at Amasa, not so much on the notion of Christ in a more general way, but it's on this issue of blood that he describes it. Yeah.
On his dream.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
yeah, the dreams are great, and other people's dreams, too.
Would that pull those out and make some kind of...
Well, I'm real interested in dreams, and so it'd be pretty easy now, given the index. Because if you look in the index that I did of these journals, one thing I was very thorough on was dreams. Just go to the journal and look up dreams, and you'll find them. I mean, I may have missed a few, but... And they're fascinating because he does. He records Joseph's dreams, Brigham's dreams, Heber's dreams, and then he records sort of interpretations of dreams. But he dreams all the time, and probably 60% of the time about fishing, but there are all kinds of other things too. Yeah, other. Yeah.
Does he give any detail on the relationship?
No, because he gives nothing detailed about women or families. In fact, you're hard-pressed to reconstruct anything about Wilfred's family life or even how many wives or children he's got just about from the journal. It's very hard to do. In fact, for the index, I went back through once just looking for names of his family, and basically it's I wrote to so-and-so, they came to me. It's just not there very much. The main thing that you really get about families that's interesting in the journal is when people get in court situations. There's some really amazingly detailed descriptions, not very many of them, but really interesting ones of divorce proceedings and excommunication proceedings that involved women and involved issues like wife beating and that kind of stuff. But there's hardly anything about polygamy in terms of domestic stuff. That's just not in the journals. Yeah.
Well, Carl Jung's monograph telling of all the negative energy of the soul.
Yeah. Well, and there is a lot of just, like I say, the other part of it is just the amazing daily things. I mean, this man loves flowers and trees and fishing and camping and all kinds of stuff like that. I think we're just about out of time. Maybe one more there.
Is he going to any kind of... not that much of that one.
The thing that's interesting is not just his visit, it's his visiting. He loved to go to San Francisco. He went to San Francisco every year and sometimes twice a year.
No, I'm talking about
the one before. No, in fact, the thing that's interesting is how little specific there is. You can make significance out of what he's talking about if you can fill in the details. He records the people that they visited there, but most of the time when he goes to San Francisco, what he talks about is sightseeing. He talks about seeing the seals, you know, out at wherever it is you go see the seals. And it's wonderful descriptions, you know, of like crazy people jumping off of bridges and fires. And what he talks about, church business, is just listing names of people, basically, in his San Francisco. I met with so-and-so. And then, like, two pages about what Badlam's house looked like or, you know, something like that. So it's very interesting that way. Okay, thank you.